Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, so welcome back. This is the second half of the patient-centered neurotechnologies navigating the innovation landscape section. And this will be the section where we will hear from Brandy Ellis, a lived experience advocate, and also that will be followed by the panel discussion where we can answer some of these burning questions and more that you'll have after Brandy speaks. So I'd like to introduce Ms. Ellis at this time. She is a passionate lived experience advocate for neuromodulation, clinical trial participants, and mental health. And her remarkable journey as a patient participant in implanted neural device clinical trials has even garnered international attention, with her story and insights featured in radio interviews with the BBC, podcast articles, and presentations at prestigious institutions. But you get to hear about it firsthand today. So please help me welcome Ms. Ellis.
Thank you very much. So I am going to start this briefly of who I am and why I'm here talking to you, and then hopefully I can share with you some of the things that I've learned and that I want you to take away from my experience. So this is me, and I have two electrodes right here, and then the wires come down the side, go down my neck, and I have a battery pacemaker that is rechargeable, implanted below the chest wall fascia for me, my little bit towards vanity. And this is why I have that. Is in my 20s, I had my very first depressive episode when I was in college, and I saw a therapist, and I went on an SSRI, and I got better. A few years later, stress at work, stress in relationships, and I had another depressive episode, and I saw another therapist, and I tried another antidepressant, and it worked, and I got better. And in my late 20s, I faced more life difficulties, some losses in my life, and I had another depressive episode. And I went on medication, and I got better. And then, in my early 30s, I was not doing real well, but didn't feel like depression. Is my depression when I was in my 20s was always me sleeping for like 20 hours a day. Just, I was slow, I was very down. This, I couldn't sleep, I had insomnia. I didn't understand that that could also be depression. And so I was trying to figure out what was wrong, and I'm seeing therapists, and I'm eventually going on medicine, and nothing is changing. In fact, I'm still getting worse, and it's getting harder to work, and nothing is going the way it should. And so we're trying more medicines and different combinations of medicines, and I am still getting worse. And I have a wonderful therapist, and we are trying all the things, and I am seeing all of the doctors, and it's going on years. And I can't work anymore. I can't do my job. And I have a master's degree, and I cannot even read a book anymore. And I used to read an entire novel at least one a week. I couldn't watch TV. I couldn't pay attention. I couldn't hold a conversation with my friends. And I am now also dealing with side effects from all of these medicines, and none of them seem to be worth how much they cost me in side effects, because I'm not really getting any better. And so we go, my family takes me to the best psychiatric hospital in the United States, McLean Hospital, outside of Boston. And I spend a little over 3 weeks there. And we start ECT. And this is the first time that I feel a little better. And I actually respond. And this is an excellent sign. So I get to go home. And we continue doing ECT from Florida, which is where my home is. And I'm taking the train to the hospital, getting ECT, and you're supposed to spread them out further and further apart so that you see how long you can go in between treatments. And mine can't get any further apart. It just stops working. And I end up having ECT 24 times, and we realize I'm not going to get better. Is I'm never going to be able to space this out enough to have a job, to be able to function. And I'm also experiencing severe side effects. So we decide that ECT is not going to solve this problem for me either. So I am at the point where I'm pretty sure I have a terminal case of depression. I can't work. My relationships with my family are suffering. I can't support myself. And I've tried everything. And nothing worked. And every doctor that I ask, what else do I do, says, we don't have anything else. You've done everything we have. And so I think this is the end for me, because I can't go on more years with this level of suffering. But I realize that there are other people in the same position as me, and maybe if I join an experiment, it won't work. You know, nothing has worked for me. I know that being in an experiment isn't going to work for me, but maybe somebody else will learn from one more thing that didn't work, right? Even in an experiment, we know, we learn things. We learn to try something else. So I decided to try and be in an experiment. And this was the one that I joined. And it was a DBS trial in Atlanta, Georgia. And my family packed me up and moved me and found me a place to live and supported me. I had to agree to move to Atlanta and live there for a year. And I was not working. And my family said, we will do this if there's a chance that this will help. The study that I did, they put the electrode sort of in this area, and the idea is that this sort of circuit, if you stimulate anywhere in that area, something might happen. And for me, it did. It worked. But being part of a clinical trial for that year, it was a lot of interviews and awake brain surgery, which we saw previously. Is being in this clinical trial was my full-time job for a year. Is I was seeing clinicians multiple times a week for hours. I was tasked with homework. I was doing sort of a rehab, cognitive, trying to learn how not to be depressed again. And it was exhausting. And There was a significant period of time where I didn't think it would be worth it to have gone through all of this. But they bolt you into, they bolt into your skull, and then they bolt the frame to the table, and then they ask you questions. And so you'll see here, I have a smile. And that is because they gave me something that made me feel a little better before I would let them put that on. And they do the experiments, and you get a sense of feeling like gravity is a little less. I don't think that there's any sort of correlation between if you respond and if you experience something on the table, but it was a very long day. Very long day. And then afterwards, I slept with frozen peas on my head for a week. Then you wait, as we waited 30 days after the surgery for any swelling, any complications to pass. And then they turn it on. And then we do testing. And this is the part that was a full-time job, is surveys and ratings and eye tracking and all of these other experiments, because the whole point of doing this is to try and help other people who are suffering with depression. So any experiment that they said, would you be willing to? Yes. Yes, I will. I haven't responded yet. And when these are being taken, is I've had the surgery, but I'm not better, not any less depressed. I'm just trying to help as many people as possible before my eventual demise. So my whole goal, my whole purpose that year was to get through the trial, help as many people as possible, and survive as long as I could. So my surgery was in October. 11/11/11 was the day my implant was turned on, and that is the day I became what I call myself a cyborg. I feel like it's kind of a cool day to become a cyborg. April 27th is when they took the measurement to see if I was a responder in the trial. And that was 6 months. And that was what I now believe a really aggressive timeline. But for me, at 6 months, that session was the first time that I had hit a 50% decrease in my symptoms. So, like, I hit the threshold right there at 6 months. And that's a 50% decrease in my symptoms. That is not me not being depressed. That is not me being a functional human being. That is just that my symptoms were so bad, and they are now 50% less terrible. So, at 6 months, this was 6 months of me doing therapy. I'm still taking therapeutic medications. I'm still doing the homework. I'm still doing the experiments. I am still doing everything I can to stay alive. And I had a 50% decrease at 6 months. A full 18 months later, I am finally in remission. That is a long time to recover from a major illness. And at no point in that was I able to work to support myself. And then I had a really, really good couple of weeks. if anybody knows anything about the depression rating scales, is, you know, something like having an upset stomach or a headache will give you a point. And so I had one session where, by some miracle, for 2 whole weeks, I hadn't had a single upset stomach or a headache, and I had a 0 score, which I do point out is not actually clinically meaningful in any way, shape, or form. But it was pretty cool for me, given that my starting score was not a good one. But I was also continuing to be interviewed pretty regularly for, how, you know, comparison's sake. So that's what got me here, is being catastrophically ill, being so sick to the point where the threat of an all-day awake brain surgery bolted to the table, possible massive complications, and where the threat of, you know, a complication where you might die is not really viewed as a negative in your frame of mind. And for me, it worked, despite everything, despite me being absolutely convinced that this would never work, that this was going to be one more situation where we are doing psychosurgery and haven't learned from our past failures. So, but no, it wasn't that at all. And I now am a fully functioning, I don't say happy. I mean, I am happy, but that's not it. Is I am mood appropriate. Like, that's what depression is. Depression is not sadness. That's sadness. Depression is an absolute inability to have an appropriate mood when good things happen, even. Is there were interviews where I am so sick, but I haven't cried in months because I have had to blunt everything. Everything hurts so much that you just blunt it. So I am now, well, yes, I am happy in my life. I have an amazing bonus life that I never expected to happen. And I am happy, but that's not what the DBS gave me. The DBS helped me get an appropriate mood. So when the world is a dumpster fire, I am appropriately anxious and I am appropriately sad when bad things happen. But when wonderful things happen and wonderful opportunities happen, I am appropriately excited and joyful. And that is what this is about. So, what have I learned? I put question marks on DBS is not a first-line treatment. The very first talk I ever gave after my clinical trial surgery was, I'm pretty sure there was exclamation points, because I was like, nobody would ever want to have brain surgery if literally anything else worked. Like, that just seems quite reasonable. But the further I get from this, the more I view the period of time where I was sick on a different spectrum. And had the technology existed, had the ability to say, we can save you the years of medication adjustments, of trying all of these treatments, trying all of these other things, knowing you're not going to respond, would I have said, yeah, let's just skip all that and go have the surgery? Probably. Had I had the ability to know what that was. So I'm not so sure that going forward, this can never be a first-line treatment. If you are in a position where you can know what you're saving, then there is something to be said for skipping right to it. I do this not to recruit people, not to tell other people to have brain implants. This is not for everybody. I have friends who suffer with mental illness and they have no interest in DBS, and that is appropriate. Is everybody should have the care that best suits them. This worked really well for me. So I would like to also point out I'm not cured. If this turns off, I will get sick again. And even though my clinical trial was not blinded or placebo-controlled, about 4 or 5 years after my trial, and I had responded, I was doing well, there was an error and it turned off, and I didn't know it turned off. Nobody knew it turned off. And I started to get sick, and I couldn't figure out why. I was, what's going on in my life? I'm interrogating, you know, all of, am I under work stress? I couldn't figure out why my mood was suddenly so very down, and it didn't seem appropriate to what was going on in my life. And it was 3 weeks later when we figured out that my device had been off. So that was sort of a impromptu blinded situation where even though I had been well, even though I had known that this experiment had worked, it was years later when that happened where I realized for the first time and truly believed in my heart, yeah, I kind of needed that surgery. This wasn't taking the easy way out. This wasn't a placebo effect for me. This wasn't something that I just didn't try hard enough to get well. This really was something that without this device, my brain doesn't work. So, big picture. That blinded part, that was really the first time where I kind of stepped back from the societal view of mental illness as laziness or weak will or just not trying hard enough. I always called it the justs, because whenever you're dealing with severe depression, you get a lot of justs. Just exercise. Just think of the positives. Just get out in nature, you know? Just try these essential oils, whatever. And it's not that those weren't always given with good humor or a kind heart, but there is no justs when you are dealing with the severity of illness that I was. I had tried ECT, every medication, inpatient, like I had tried everything. There was no just anything anymore. So, yeah. But viewing it as an actual brain disorder and not a weakness on my part, that has changed my entire outlook on everything I went up to before then. Because I promise, if you know somebody who has mental illness, or you have a mental illness, I have yet to meet a single one who wasn't told at some point in time that they were malingering, that they just weren't trying hard enough, that this was somehow their fault. So when you stop doing that, when you stop believing that, it's transformative. Ongoing needs is, we need people involved. This is for us, these treatments that we're talking about, they're for those of us who suffer. And I don't take anything away from any of our other speakers that perhaps they aren't the ones with epilepsy or with depression or with Parkinson's, and they are doing the work because we value their work on our behalf. It is for us. And we are so thankful that the science is being advanced. But more needs to be done with us. Earlier, and not just us as patients, but us as caregivers, us as people who have a voice in society for where we should prioritize care. And so I advocate for my point of view, which is a patient-centric approach, is the ability to create, develop, and move science and technology and solutions ahead to help people by using the opinions of people that you are trying to help. And so incentives for participation. I know how incredibly fortunate I am that I had a family that could support me, that I did not have children or a spouse or somebody else or a job or any of those things that took away from me focusing 100% of my time recovering on me. And I was not going to end up homeless, and my family was not going to let me starve. And that comes from immense privilege. So when we talk about why science isn't moving any faster, why aren't they becoming commercially available sooner, I would like to ask each of you to contemplate why you haven't yet participated in a clinical trial for literally anything. It doesn't matter if you don't have a condition. Like, healthy subjects are wanted in all clinical trials. Is it because there's an immense burden of finding a trial, participating in a trial, taking time off from work, away from childcare, of investing your time and energy into something? Now, when you are desperately ill, when you have, you know, and I speak from the US healthcare system, which has not always been amazing when it comes to mental health issues, I had doctors who were refusing to see me anymore because they had nothing for me. Is when you are at your sickest, you're least able to function, is when the clinical trial says, we would like you to go back to every provider you have seen for the last 5 years and get all of their notes and get all of the releases signed and submit to us a timeline and every medication you've been on and every dosage. And that's what it takes to get into a clinical trial. And so getting a more diverse group of people in your clinical trials is going to take making the inclusion of people a priority. And that means helping them where they need help to enable their participation. Other things I would like people to consider as you create devices or deal with any devices is if the people who make my device just suddenly go away, go belly up, I mean, I have this in my brain. Abandonment is a significant fear for people who are getting these sorts of implants because it happens. New technologies get created and they get put into people, and then those companies go out of business. So when we have people talk about that it's $150 million in 10 years to get something to market, add in potentially having to cover lifetime care for those people who you experimented on. Right now, this is the kind of thing that I look at, but Neuralink has not publicly committed to post-trial access or care for the people who are involved in those experiments. These are people getting implants in their brain. And there's no real requirement that their healthcare in the future is not going to be negatively impacted by their participation in this clinical trial. Also, I would really like people to focus on security a little bit more. Is my device is
basically only hack-proof by the fact that you have to be really close to me to do it. And I'm kind of hopeful that people who are in my immediate vicinity don't want to do that to me. So, because there's no password protection. There's nothing. This goes to my brain. Could we prioritize a little security in this Internet of Things world where we're moving towards? Especially if it's going in somebody's body. That would be great. I would also like there to be incentives for compatibility. Like, for pacemakers, for heart pacemakers, they're trying to make them all interchangeable so that you can swap batteries. That's not a thing I have. I don't have the option to go to any battery provider to get my next battery. It's proprietary hardware. So it's even riskier for abandonment if I can't swap to something else on the market. Empowerment. I promise. When you take patient voices, we are doing it generally to help you help us. So when you're not getting feedback, it's because we need an incentive. There are plenty of times where any of us, like in our normal day-to-day, we will give feedback on something, we'll answer a survey, or you know, how was your interaction with this teleprompter or you know, call center? And we don't respond, we don't give that information because we don't think it matters. So incentivize the people who you're working with that if you have an idea for this device that we're giving you, we're gonna listen. Incentivize them that their voice matters, that you will listen to them when they have issues with what you're working on together. Incentivize them to stick around for the long term. And help them understand all of the ways in which this may or may not impact the rest of their life. Is the slide about, you know, kids, you know, is this going to allow my parents to control my brain? You know, those, let me tell you, those are all questions I had. But knowing that I have, you know, can't get an MRI or I need to remember to take my remote control to turn it off to get an EKG, those sorts of things of what does and does not matter, helping people understand the broader context of what this implant means for them is exactly where we want to take this, is become holistic. So this is basically my story and why I'm here and what I would like you to learn from this. So please be kind to the people in your life, because I know you all have people in your life who are suffering with mental illness. We all do. And understand that everybody is doing the best that they can, even when you don't think they are. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.